Hello and welcome to Radio EduTalk. This is David Noble in Dalgety Bay, and I'm delighted to welcome to the show this evening Professor Kate Wall of the School of Education at the University of Strathclyde. And this evening we're going to be looking into visual data and how it can provide insight into children's learning. And welcome to EduTalk, Kate.
Hello. Hello, thank you for having me.
Yeah, we're delighted to have you on the show and really looking forward to hearing all about this evening's topic. I will say that not always these days, but we're very fortunate this evening that we are broadcasting live at edutalk.cc. So if you have a comment or a question for Kate, then you can get in touch by email. That's edutalker@hotmail.co.uk, or pop something up on Twitter using the hashtag edutalk, or send us an at reply or a direct message. And to start off with, Kate, could you just give listeners a kind of brief background to your career?
Oh, right. I'm a primary teacher. By background, I taught for a number of years down in the southwest of England. But while teaching a class of year fours, so 7 and 8 year olds, I started my PhD based on my experiences of teaching and based on my class. So I was a practitioner inquirer before I probably knew what a practitioner inquiry was. And through that process of doing that doctorate, I moved to Newcastle University, other end of England, to work, and got a job as a researcher, and slowly worked my way through the ranks of schools of education, Newcastle, Durham, and now Strathclyde, with a commitment to teachers and what they're doing in school, and trying to do research that's hopefully useful in helping them have good conversations with the kids in their classes.
So is that where your interest in visual data came from, you know, your kind of early career experiences?
I think it came later on. It came from, I mean, I've made a career really of being a visual methodologist from something that was common sense as a teacher. So I was always interested in students' opinions and students' thinking around what was happening to them. My classroom was always quite kind of noisy, much to my head teacher's disgust. It was always a place of relative chaos. But it was because I was encouraging dialogue, encouraging talk, and maybe as I learned to do that effectively, it wasn't, as I said, the calmest. But when I came into the university, we wanted to capture children's thinking, and the UNCRC was around and influencing research more and more. And I wanted to talk to young children, and Student Voices Afield was with older kids, and I wanted to talk to younger ones because I knew from my practitioner experience they had something important to say. And we weren't asking it in the right way. And so I moved into, I did something that was common sense for a teacher, which is to use visual prompts to support those conversations, and to take away the barrier of literacy and numeracy for some of those kids that for that was a, that's a barrier to having a voice. So yeah, it was a common sense decision.
Yeah, so we're talking really about visual research methodologies, but also approaches then that teachers and educational managers, for example, could be using at a local level in terms of the rights of the child and ensuring that voice is heard within the school or the class setting.
Yeah, I don't see the two as different. I think there is there's an isolation between research methods and good pedagogy, which I don't think is helpful, particularly in the domain of practitioner inquiry. We need to be more aware of those effective techniques we use to elicit children's perspectives as teachers and how they might be useful in a research domain, and vice versa, to be honest. There's some good research techniques out there that teachers don't know about, and would be helpful in them doing their jobs. We just need a bigger bridge between the two. One of the key things I see my role as doing is trying to sit on the boundary between pedagogy and methodology, and try and talk about what's useful, and how we can explore the children's learning to both benefit the research community and the teaching community.
And I just wonder for the next few moments or so, Kate, the paper of yours and your colleagues that I read recently was the one around using cartoon storyboards to investigate student perceptions of them learning something new, whether that was in school or outside of school. So maybe using that as a starting point, could you just tell us, tell listeners a little bit about that particular research project?
Yeah, I was involved in a research project that went on for nearly 10 years. It's one of the longest research projects that I'm aware of, funded. It was cut by the coalition government in the early 2010s, but it involved nearly over 70 schools from nursery right the way up to secondary. It involved two FE colleges and some higher education teachers as well. All engaging in what does effective learning look like. So the project was called Learning to Learn, sponsored by the Campaign for Learning. It was a practitioner inquiry project. We were in partnership with the teachers who were exploring what effective learning looked like in their contexts. And our job as the researchers was to look at the common messages across all those locations that were all four corners of England, from Cornwall right the way up to Northumberland. So the templates were one tool that we used to try and elicit what children thought about their learning. Our hunch was that children in the project were aware of their learning in a different way to other children. Now, we have no comparison data set, but what we do have is a data set that looks across children aged from 5 right the way up to 16. And we asked them to draw out the story in 6 blank boxes of how they learned something new. And they could choose what that learning was. It could be school, it could be home, it could be sport, it could be music. They chose and to articulate that as best they can. And then we did some analysis on that to look at what the key findings were across these 212 children that completed the task.
And what were the conclusions of yourself and the research team?
The conclusions were that these children were able to articulate their learning. They could see a narrative. One of the interesting things was that school learning was difficult to articulate. So they really struggled with showing the progression in school learning. They got better at it as they got older, but particularly young children really struggled with that and often chose things like sport or learning a musical instrument where it was much more obvious when they couldn't do it and when they practiced to do it and then when they could. The teachers in the project were really aware that how they talk about learning, particularly in the short term with children, was really important, and they needed to get better at it and showing that process of how, what does it look like when you don't know, how do you practice, how do you get better, and what does it look like when you do. The other thing we took from it was the fact that these kids understood that it was going to be hard work, that learning took a lot of perseverance. There's one example of a child learning to surf down in Cornwall, and he falls off. He shows that he falls off that surfboard nearly 20 times in different pictures, and sometimes it hurts. He said, "Ow," you know. But when he managed to do it for the first time, there's this feeling of success and achievement that wouldn't have been there if he'd found it easy. And so again, the teachers analysing them with us were very aware that they needed to create spaces where kids could persevere and try hard, and how did they create an environment where that was okay and it was safe to do that kind of failing, so that when they did achieve, they had that feeling of success. If it was too easy, then they wouldn't get that feeling of success in the end.
In terms of methodologies to gather visual data, Kate, I know in the conclusions of that particular paper, you were reflecting on whether the storyboard technique was in of itself the best way, or you were looking at advantages and disadvantages of using that approach, whether it's to do with the age of the pupil, or whether they're within a formal setting or not. So that maybe leads us into, I know you talk about pupil views templates, so can you tell us a little bit about where you're at, in particular with the storyboard technique, and what other alternatives you've been working with and got success with?
Yeah, so because I'm using my teacher head, I suppose, a lot of the time, I tend to get carried away with some of these visual techniques, and we go and do it, and then we think about it methodologically afterwards as to what worked and what didn't work. The storyboard technique, we did six, A4 sheet of paper was given to each child with six boxes on in a 3x2 grid. If we were to do it again, we'd probably do it as a strip of six rather than that 3x2, because the format, particularly the younger children, encouraged them to have a beginning, middle and end. And we really beat ourselves up a bit, because as teachers, we knew that that's how you teach storytelling in primary. That's how we taught storytelling in primary. And I think that the kids just fell into that routine. So you live and learn about how these techniques work. We know the cartoons work really well. I've got quite a lot of publications with my colleague Steve Higgins from Durham University around people who've used templates. We've used them a lot with teachers. They are a one-off set example of a cartoon where the children fill in the thought bubbles and speech bubbles to articulate what they're saying and what they're thinking. What we've shown is those tools are really good at getting at children's metacognitive awareness. They're thinking about the way that they think. And that's really important for teachers to have that insight, but also from the research community. As metacognition goes up in the sort of policy awareness with the Education Endowment Foundation toolkit, John Hattie's work all put metacognition self-regulation at the top of their rankings as something that's cheap and effective. How we assess metacognition effectively in young children becomes really important. So we know the templates work very well for that. And we thought that the storyboard might get at something that was over time. It didn't. It got at something else. But there is something across the two about cartoons as a way of supporting children in a pedagogically appropriate way to articulate this process of learning that's quite difficult. It's quite difficult to articulate.
And I know that you can already tell from the broadcast so far, Kate, but you're very passionate about, you know, democratic spaces for learners to talk about their experiences as well as learning about learning. So what other approaches have you used in your time as an academic, and you know, what kind of experimentation or innovative approaches are you involved in, or should we be aware of in terms of colleagues across the country?
I think that what haven't I been involved in, to be honest? I'm always taking techniques, pedagogically effective techniques, from the classroom into the research world. So I've used a lot of techniques that listeners will be aware of, things like opinion lines, fortune lines, diamond nine, diamond ranking activities, odd one outs, Venn diagrams, just those good pedagogic tools for eliciting children's thinking and taking them into the research world as effective ways for supporting researchers in exploring what kids think. As I said at the beginning, I think we create an artificial barrier between what we do in teaching to elicit kids' thinking and what we do in research to elicit kids' thinking. So we're always looking for novel ways to support that conversation, to find ways of supporting what is, you know, this saying what you think, well, having a voice, and having a voice particularly for young children needs scaffolding. Again, we know that as teachers, so how we can do that with a research agenda becomes really important. A lot of them have a visual element, not always. I get quite creative with video and photographs, and thinking about how we can use those. I've given kids cameras, given teachers cameras, and to see what kind of their perspective. And often I do the analysis in partnership with the teachers of those children, because I think it's about creating that dialogue that is inclusive of everyone that's involved in that context. So a lot of my work is around trying to support voice as a dialogue that is supportive of not only the kids learning, but also the teachers learning as well.
And this fits with a kind of passion that you spoke about earlier for practitioner inquiry, and it's about teachers as researchers, but possibly also students as researchers.
Yeah, again, in the Learn to Learn project, it was all we started off that it was all about student outcomes, and we thought it was going to be about student learning, and it was. But what we found out that if we wanted the students to understand their learning, then the teachers had to understand their learning. If we wanted students to have a voice, then teachers have to have a voice. If we wanted students to be metacognitive, then we needed teachers to be metacognitive. And so a big part of the project came about how we worked with teachers to support them in seeing this potential in themselves and therefore in their teaching and learning with children. And what we then saw was lots of teachers then start to give power to the kids and support students as researchers groups. We had year ones, so that's P1, being learning detectives in Northumberland local authority, where they had clipboards and deer stalker hats and were going around detecting learning. Well, it's students as researchers, but in a pedagogically appropriate way with year one. We had student councils that included 4-year-olds right the way up to 11-year-olds spending budgets of £5,000 because the head teacher believed in them so much he was going to give them a budget and they could spend it how they saw fit. That kind of belief and that kind of commitment to these approaches doesn't happen overnight, and it needs teachers who are prepared to take risks and do something a bit different and have faith in their students. And that only happens through those conversations starting in a simple way.
And whether we're talking about student councils or the fact that in the professional standards for the General Teaching Council for Scotland, you know, we have practitioner research in there, or even just, you know, looking at the ongoing convention, UNCRC, you would say that this is something that all teachers need to be increasingly aware of and indeed engage in regularly.
I've talked to the GTCS and the Standards Review Committee about my thinking about practitioner inquiry. There's a piece in the GTCS magazine this month that I've written. I moved to Scotland with my son on purpose because of some of the stuff around practitioner inquiry. I know it's no ideal, but I like the fact that it's there in the standards. It's something that everyone should be doing. In the 2 years since I've moved up, I've seen two different types of practitioner inquiry occurring. You've got the practitioner inquiry by project, which tends to be organised by an outside agency. It's a one-off. It's a piece of research. Probationers are doing it. NQTs are doing it. But then it finishes when that organisation or when that time finishes. And that's it. We've done practitioner inquiry. You've got the other type, which is practitioner inquiry as a stance, which is much more of a personal drive to inquire and move forward. Neither of those two are better or worse, but there doesn't seem to be a communication between the two. And so we need to support communities where those two types of practitioner inquiry can come together to work together. And the key obstacle to get over is the obstacle of research. And while the model of research that's being peddled in practitioner inquiry is research heavy as an academic model of research, then that turns teachers off and it becomes something that is hard to do, that is extra, and that's not helpful in getting teachers to do practitioner inquiry. If it's extra, if it's done in your free time, if it's done around the normal practice of teaching and learning, then it's not being useful to your thinking. And so a lot of the techniques that I'm developing and working on are trying to embed practitioner inquiry, to embed that process of collecting evidence as something that is fundamentally useful to the teaching and learning process. So it's part of what teachers do every day. It's not extra, it's not additional, it's not designing a questionnaire. It's part of the data that's useful with working when they're working with their children in their classroom.
We're coming towards the end of the broadcast, Kate, but I wonder if you're in a position at this moment in time to say a little bit more about that, to give us a flavour of what teachers might be involved in the future, or be encouraged to be involved in, or new approaches, or new research, or if it's too early for that, where would we find out information on this further down the line?
I think key is generating spaces for teachers to have conversations with each other, and they need to be quite diverse groups, not just all the primary teachers talking to primary teachers. We need to talk across contexts, the secondary teachers talking to primary teachers, and FE and different locations, but also with experts from the universities and from organisations such as the GTCS and SCL. Different perspectives that challenge and support and give rise to questions, because that's what inquiry is all about. It's about producing questions and asking questions. I've written quite a bit about how those communities need to come together and what needs to be the characteristics in them. First and foremost, it needs to be the individual teacher's decision on what they explore. It's got to be their question, and it's got to be something that they see as useful to the learning of the children in their class. All the professional learning literature says that professional learning must be closely linked to the needs of the students with which that teacher works. So that's the first thing. It's got to be there, and then the teacher has to be able to decide what evidence is useful in answering that question, and when the inquiry is finished. It's a principle of autonomy. The second thing is this idea of dialogue. They've got to be able to talk about what they're finding and how they're finding it out and what that means to them. They've got to be able to talk about failing. That's a big one, because if you're going to do research and you're going to be neutral, then sometimes it won't work, and that's okay. You still learn from it. In fact, you probably learn from it more when it fails than when it works. You then got the principle of dissonance. So when things are not working, if you're asking questions, you're likely to get more questions. You're also going to realize the complexity, and so you've got to be able to deal with that complexity and be able to see that things might not work the way that you expected, and you might be challenged by different individuals to think differently. I mean, if you're going to do student voice, you can almost guarantee that if you're going to listen, you're going to hear some challenging stuff from the kids. Are you ready for that? Are you ready for that kind of dissonance to your thinking? And the fourth principle of those networks is to think about how the practitioner inquiry connects to other stuff. So I've already said that I see that student voice is connected to teacher voice. Teacher practitioner inquiry is connected to inquiry-based curriculum and inquiry-based approaches in the classroom. Metacognition of students is linked to metacognition of teachers. And if we can start seeing those connections and seeing the parallels between what we're doing, then again it closes down those feedback loops between teacher learning and student learning. Teacher learning does not become something extra, it becomes something complementary and supportive of what they do every day. And it makes what you do every day more doable. And we all need a bit of that.
Okay, that's a great place to leave it. Fantastic insight into your current work. And how can listeners find out more about your own work and the work of your team? And also, I just wonder if there's a text that you would particularly recommend for somebody that will have at least background awareness and knowledge about this, but maybe to prepare themselves better for the next step.
Yeah, so I think if you're interested in practitioner inquiry, then the GTCS magazine piece is probably the first place I would go. That there is also a book that we wrote, Vivian Bournfield, Elaine Hall, and myself, called Action Research in the Classroom, which is a how-to guide for teachers. It talks about the kind of data that is available in schools and how to use that as a starting point for practitioner inquiry. It's written with examples of teachers. Named examples of teachers because they did the work from the project, and so that's probably a good place to go to. I know it's available on Glow, that book, because SCL use it quite a lot. in terms of student voice and working around student voice, I've just finished a project which was called Look Who's Talking, eliciting the voice of children from birth to seven. And so I've been working with a variety of different experts in the field of young children's voice, on the theory that if we can do it with children who are two, then we can do it with older ones. And so there's a website for that project called www.voicebirthto7.co.uk. www.voicebirthto7.co.uk, then the word two, not the number two. And on there, we are just about to release 8 talking posters, talking point posters, which will summarise our thinking about how you need to create a context for working with kids to elicit their voice.
Kate, thank you so much for taking time out this evening to join us on Radio Edutalk. Absolutely fascinating. And I wish you and your colleagues well with your future work. And you're most welcome to come back on and share some of that with listeners again.